Jason Finaro, Discord, the theme music for our literary program, Literary Discord, which tries to talk about books and publishing from a somewhat different point of view, not just the commercial aspects and the numbers of advances and all that, but what happens to serious publishing? Does it have a future? Is it still alive? What can we do to help it? I'm Hans Koning. As listeners to my book program know, we don't have authors who've come with a book and talk about that book. I know that is sometimes satisfying. Usually it seems rather hopeless to me because the interviewer has usually only read the cover's copy, if that. But our guest today, John Nichols, is not here just to talk about a book, and I didn't ask him because of that, but because his career, what I know of it, which is quite a lengthy one already, seemed to me typical for certain ups and downs in publishing and followed almost precisely the declining curve of serious book publishing. I mean, in the way his books are received by the publishers and the struggles to get it published by a serious house. I think John Nichols, as far as I knew, is best known because of his Milagre Beanfield War, which was filmed by Robert Redford. I just talked to him before today, and he told me, which I had forgotten, that The Sterile Cuckoo, which was a very famous film with Liza Minnelli, was also a novel of his. I must begin now by saying that I certainly don't mean to imply in any way that the success or the seriousness of a novel is linked to its being made into a film. There must be very many splendid novels which are just not suitable to be filmed, and other novels which have been ruined when they were made into a film. It's just that films and the options filmmakers take on novels and then very often drop again when it turns out that it doesn't work have played a large role in keeping writers alive, as I only know too well because I've had the same experience. So, John, I wanted to ask you, first of all, to say something about your experiences with the three books which have been filmed and how this has influenced your welcome by the increasingly commercial big houses in this country?
The experiences with books being filmed have been interesting, often a lot of fun, sometimes very frustrating. Whether or not they have influenced my experience with bigger houses, I don't know. The first novel I published, The Sterile Cuckoo, was published by sort of a smaller house named David McKay, but it made a sort of publishing splash, I think, because it was rare even back then in 1964 to have books get published over the transom when the author just kind of sent them in cold to publishing houses. And sort of everything good happened in that book, from being a Literary Guild alternate to being bought up by Avon Paperbacks to going out on film option immediately to being made into a movie very quickly that was actually a popular film right off the bat. And in fact, that movie opened up sort of every opportunity any of us have ever dreamed about in America. The only problem was that at the same time, I became really heavily politicized by going down to Guatemala in 1964 and being shocked by the kind of poverty that existed there and the American influence on that poverty. And then the minute I got back to New York in sort of the spring of 1964, I started researching the Vietnam War and the United States presence in Southeast Asia. So I became so radical so fast that I literally just pulled out of the publishing world in New York City in about 1965 or 66 and tried to become a radical leftist novelist quite unsuccessfully. And spent the next 7 or 8 years writing books that I couldn't publish, partially because they were polemical, shrill tracts, and partially also because they were really terribly written books. And so I went very quickly from being kind of a bright young talent in New York with all the possibilities open to me to being kind of a raving lunatic, Marxist-Leninist, overthrow the capitalist system organizer and polemical writer who really didn't know how to write polemically at all. And it took me a long time to sort of recover from that and get my balance back again and managed to publish a third novel, The Milagro Beanfield War, which came out in 1974, 9 years after The Sterile Cuckoo.
Well, first, a trivial question, or only seemingly trivial. Did you work with an agent with The Sterile Cuckoo after you had been
No,
accepted?
I couldn't get an agent when I was trying to sell The Sterile Cuckoo. But once it had been published, agents just fell out of the sky, begging to be my agent. The first one that walked through the door, I said, you. His name was Perry Knowlton at Curtis Brown in New York. And he remained my agent for 35 years until he retired.
Oh, that's sort of a happy note. I would think he didn't drop you when you became too red for him.
No, not at all.
I see.
No, we had many fights in the very beginning because I simply did not want to have a film career the way, publishing career the way agents and publishers set it up in New York City.
Right.
I really wanted to have it on my own terms. And it took a bit of training, I guess, and arguments between me and the agent until the agent backed off and did it my way. But basically, the way I sort of operated my career from that moment on is I really never used the agent to sell books at all. I had the good fortune to find an editor at Holt named Marion Wood, and we stayed together for 28 years. Until she left for Putnam's. And I would just hand my stuff into her. And if she wanted to publish it, she'd say, great. And if she didn't want to publish it, she would reject it.
And what did you do then? Send it elsewhere?
Many of the books she was a great reader, so I would send her first draft, third draft, fifth draft, eighth draft, and I think she was very helpful, and the books that she rejected didn't deserve to get published, by and large. So I was kind of grateful. I trusted her to, save me from myself, in a way. And it turned out that she did not really enjoy publishing nonfiction or photo essays, and I did a number of books like that, and when she would reject them, then I would go try and find another publisher.
I see.
And one of the books that she rejected, I published with Knopf. It was called If Mountains Die. A couple of other ones that she had no interest in, I published with a little publisher in Utah called Peregrine Smith. A couple of other ones I wound up publishing with Norton, W.W. Norton, because I had a very good friend there.
Who was he?
His name was Bill Rusin. He's still there.
Yeah.
He's the head of sales at Norton.
Right.
But he wasn't really an editor, but he loved photography. So we did two books together. Literally, I got to design them, lay them out, make up the dummy, do everything, right? It was kind of the Bobbsey Pins twins do publishing.
I see.
It was fun.
How did you fare when both your the agent and the editor moved and we all retired?
Well, that's...
How long
I had a tough time because when I had sort of figured out the rhythm to my life for, 35 years or so. And I didn't have an agent for a while, and then I realized that I would probably have a difficult time publishing another novel in the ambience, the current ambience, of New York and publishing.
Yes.
And a friend gave me the name of an agent named Kathy Anderson, and I gave her my most recent novel called The Voice of the Butterfly. My editor, Marion Wood, had rejected it over the years. I worked about 12 years on it, and she just never liked it. It never was a book that worked out. And this new agent had hope for it and said she could sell it, and she actually managed to sell it.
I see.
Last year, although we went through a lot of argumentation and conflict relating to how I wanted to go about selling it and that kind of thing.
Right.
And I'm still very sort of nervous about proceeding in this brave new world, but because as far as I can figure out, nobody wants to run the machine the way I've always run it.
Yes.
You know, I've always managed to have good luck by being very personal and developing relationships that lasted a long time with people that I trusted.
Does she have her own agency, this Kathy Anderson?
She just started her own agency. She's literally a two-person agent.
I see.
It's called Anderson Grinberg in New York. She's very aggressive and very tough New York agent, I think, and probably very good.
But the Voice of the Butterfly isn't out yet, is it?
It'll be out in June.
I see.
In a couple months.
Oh,
I actually have the
galleys?
The books. No, I have the bound copies of the books. Yeah.
Oh, the best of Irish luck with it. But now to get to what is really what it's all about in my life too. When you talk, say, thrill, and another word you used, polemical, it seemed almost as, or perhaps not even almost, that you were putting the blame on yourself for not getting these books published.
Well, yeah, I mean, I have never really quarreled with sort of the publishing world because I think I've been very lucky compared to many people that I had an agent and an editor and a publisher that were very supportive. And also, I'm not a very good writer. I mean, I am a writer who I've probably written 80 books in my life or 90 books. I've only published 18 of them. And many of the books that I write just simply don't work out. You know, it's not a question of some great literature that publishers are rejecting. I mean, that's my opinion, right?
So you have 60 books in the various drawers of your desk?
Oh, my God. I have 3 storage lockers with bookshelves in them to the ceiling and floor and all the way back to the back, loaded with manuscript boxes of various books that I've written and of humongous drafts for books that I've written.
John, I think you're just too damn modest because I feel very akin to in the experience that political books which political between quotes, any novel in which the hero or the anti-hero does not seem to be at ease with or the anti-heroine with the world we live in and suggests that it's not the best of all possible worlds. Anish's book, which I have written many too, Christopher Lehman Haupt promptly labels tendentious. And
right.
They are poison as far as the publishers are concerned.
Uh-huh.
I would ask you, as if we were in a courtroom, wouldn't it be rather that than your own lack of finesse that doomed these books?
Well, I'm sure that my politics probably made it harder to feel really sympathetic to the stuff that I was writing, but I have found that when the writing was really going good, that the politics didn't seem to be a factor that kept them from getting published. I have 2 books coming out this June. One is a novel that, you know, has a lot of radical up against the wall, honky MF or black power is going to get your mama, you know, echo doomsday, global warming, back off capitalism, destroying the world in it, that will be brought out by Chronicle Books, which is sort of a mid-sized publisher in San Francisco. And then I have a small book length, it's a book length radical political essay that's coming, that Milkweed Editions in Minneapolis is bringing out.
Right.
And it's a radical diatribe, you know.
I see.
And chances are maybe that a larger publisher would not have brought it out, right?
But, more than chances, I would think.
Yeah.
That
but
certainty.
But I suppose my experience is a little strange, because one of my problems in life is that, and this goes back to when I was 16 years old, is that I write lots of books really quickly, and then I rewrite them hundreds of times, each book, and it's really difficult for me to make a book work. So my experience in not getting books published isn't just political books, right? It's also just all kinds of books that simply don't work out.
But presumably a sympathetic publisher or agent even would, I don't know, help you, if that's not too patronizingly put.
It might be. I literally, you know, abandoned the agent in a way. The agent sold the Milagro Beanfield War for me in 1973. Perry Knowlton did. And after that, every book that I sold, I basically did the deal with the editor at the publisher, and then she would just hand the contract to the agent to rubber stamp, right?
Right.
I mean, I never asked the agent again to go out in the market and sell a book until I asked the new agent, Kathy Anderson, to try and sell
Butterfly.
The Voice of the Butterfly, yeah.
Well, the thing is, you know, well, it's now it's really different again because the Cold War is supposedly over.
Right.
But all those years we were told how in the Soviet Union and other places books were banned and the public and made impossible for the public to read unless they had those type manuscripts, samizdats. And I've always been I've always answered, we have and written in various places where they were willing to publish this, but we had our own censorship. It was a censorship of the market and of all sorts of factors. It was obviously there wasn't some one guy making phone calls, but
right.
Certainly, I mean, I wrote a book about China which had been accepted by a French publisher, and then a week later the French publisher was taken over by Time Life, and 2 weeks later they dropped the book. That was always, there's always a revelation to many people here who think that that's really a free open market. So I'd like you to muse on that for a moment. Apart from your own idiosyncrasies,
right.
How free is our press, and what is happening at the moment when marketing censorship seems to be much more powerful than any other.
Yeah, I mean, there's always been a huge censorship all across the board in publishing. I noticed it a lot, you know, given the weirdness of my own career. I mean, I have so many friends, particularly African American, Native American, a minority, Chicano writers, who literally could not get published, right, for political or ethnic or whatever reasons. I know I dealt with the making of the Milagro Beanfield War for 15 years, an enormous amount of racism and prejudice against just putting any money into a film where the principal characters were Latino characters, right?
Yes. Was it Redford who made it finally possible, or isn't that...
No. I didn't want Redford to have anything to do with the movie, because I figured you would just be compounding problems by having a blonde, blue-eyed actor, director, making a movie of a book written by a blonde, blue-eyed writer about, essentially, you know, Chicano people.
Yes.
So I rejected Redford's advances and rejected the advances of a lot of people, and gave the option to a Chicano producer named Moctezuma Esparza. And we got a grant from the National Endowment of the Humanities to make a little film for public television. And then a couple of years down the road, he signed a joint venture agreement with Redford, which took it out of that realm and thrust it into the big movie realm. And he probably did that because his struggle to get the film made was almost impossible, right? Because nobody wanted to fund or really support the film.
Yeah, but the soul of the book was saved in the end. It was not. It was.
I think it was. Yeah. No. It was quite remarable. But.
Well, Redford is a pretty radical guy. He used to be.
Yeah.
Blue eyes or not.
Sure. But the project for years it was simply ran up against a brick wall. You know, where people would say, "Who wants to see a film about a bunch of Mexicans?" Essentially, right? I mean, there was an enormous amount of racism, and I know that when I first moved to the Southwest in 1969, that many of my friends, like Rudy Anaya, Orlando Romero, Leo Romero, just all kinds of indigenous writers, had a terrible time trying to get published, and the only way they could get published at all was through very small alternate, you know, presses.
Right.
Set up specifically to try and meet their needs. I mean, big time publishing was not going to do that at all.
So, yeah, that is a surprising aspect of your case, because you had at least two, I don't know about the third one, solid successes also from a commercial point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And the experience is that no matter what how black the hearts are of these various large publishing houses,
mm-hmm.
if they smell money, they don't give a damn what you write. So
yeah.
Somehow that still didn't bridge the gap to Simon & Schuster or Random House or whatever. Not
yeah.
that's always desirable, but one would have expected them to drop their principles for money's sake.
Yeah.
But it didn't work that way, as far as I understand you, in your case.
Yeah, I mean, I have, it's difficult for me to complain about the career that I've had, because I think I was very fortunate in that I basically dealt with just a couple of people over 3.5 decades, right, who were open to my work. I never made much money off the work at all. People think that I'm a best-selling writer, which is not true at all. Essentially, I earned a living the last 20 years, from 1980 to the present, by writing screenplays for Hollywood. And the royalties from my various books amount to almost nothing.
I am
considered a mid-list writer. None of my novels in an initial release has ever sold more than 10,000 books. And
But nowadays, now that it seems that full-page ads are necessary to sell a book, the small houses, no matter how serious and above board they are, they just don't have the resources, no?
No. I mean, I published a book last year with an academic press, University of New Mexico Press, and they gave me a $1,500 advance, and they printed up 2,500 copies of the book. That's all.
And place no ads.
And no, they don't have the money to place ads.
Yeah.
And one of my books this year, being brought out by Milkweed Editions in Minneapolis. I mean, they gave me a $1,500 advance, and that's it. That's probably all I'll ever see from the book. And they don't have money to do advertising or stuff like that.
Okay.
On the other hand, the Chronicle, San Francisco publisher, bringing out the novel.
Yeah.
They actually paid $35,000 advance, and I'm going to wind up doing, I think, 16 or 18 or 20 book signings, right, to help support it when they publish it.
I see. Listen, we're running out of time, but there's one thing I want to ask you. I hope you come back one day, because we have to talk about this more if you want. You said you moved from New York because you realized that scene was not just not yours. because New York obviously has had at all times a very solid group of radical and very left-wing people. In,
sure.
And I would assume that you might feel better served there than in New Mexico. Why did you leave New York?
I left New York. I'd been 6 years in New York City. I had a little baby. I had no money. I had no place to write. I had a little apartment. You couldn't even shut a door in it.
I see.
I was writing in a coffee shop, and then I would go over to NYU and use the study carrels.
Okay.
And I was burned out on just constant war in the streets in New York and all of that. But, you know, I was drawn to New Mexico because of the political situation here. I figured it was sort of like a third world country. I mean, it was like a colonial situation.
Yeah.
I wanted to continue organizing and being a part of the movement. I had been reading El Grito del Norte in New York City. I used to go up to the 8th Street bookstore and buy it whenever it came out. I was very interested in Reyes Tijerina and, the land-grant movement out here.
Yeah.
So I figured I would be moving to a place where it would be possible to continue being, active
right,
as I had been in New York City, and this certainly proved to be true.
John, I must stop. Our time is up. Thank you very much, and the best of luck again with the Butterfly, Voice of the Butterfly, and I hope you'll be back one day.
I hope so, too.
Keep well.
All right, take care.
You have listened to John Nichols, a Californian-born writer who now lives in New Mexico. His most famous novels are probably Sterile Cuckoo and The Minagra Beanfield War. But he was here not to talk about specific books, but about his career as such and what happens to it in these very difficult times for publishing. We've called this program Literary Discord because that's what we're dealing with the problems of publishing as such in these very hard times for serious literature, rather than this one specific book. You're the man here. John Nichols was my guest. We will be back on Thursday the 24th of May at noon. This is our next broadcast. I'm Hans Koning, and the producer of the program is Scott Harris. Thank you for listening.